This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Luc-Olivier Dumeble.
And I'm Yannick Magnan.
And what's our topic this week, Yannick?
Being productive on the iPad Pro and the Apple Watch.
Nice. And before we start, I know that you have some follow-up.
Yeah, very briefly, we have a little bit of follow-up. Naturally, it wouldn't be an episode of Limitless Possibility without some follow-up on mobile payments. So let's do it really quickly. Apple Pay launched in China right before we started recording on February 18th. In China time. So that has just gone live. I don't know the complete details. I just know that it's launched in China. The details were leaked a little bit earlier this week by another Chinese bank, and now it's gone live. Of interest to us is that iOS 9.2.1 contains symbols that seem to indicate that Interac payment network support may be coming to Apple Pay. Interac is the card network that most of the major banks here in Canada use. So this would include RBC, CIBC, Scotiabank, TD, Desjardins, BMO, Canada Trust, Laurentian Bank, National Bank, and the Credit Union Central of Canada. So that's pretty good coverage of all of the major banks in Canada.
And it will also include my bank, Tangerine, too.
Awesome. So rumors right now seem to be indicating that they would be launching or announcing the other countries that would be supported by Apple Pay and other networks at next month's iPhone and iPad event, which we are probably going to talk about when it happens. So that's cool. Next up, I've got a PC gaming anecdote to go with our last episode. So yesterday was the launch day for Street Fighter V, which is a PS4 exclusive on console, but it also has a PC release. And friend of the show, Woof, is an illustrator who does a lot of art revolving around characters from fighting games. He has a lot of shirts that he's made, some of which have been worn by developers of the actual fighting games he drew characters for. So that's actually really awesome. I love him. And he installed the PC version of Street Fighter V on his computer this morning, and it didn't work. And would you like to guess the reason why it didn't work on his computer?
I won't try to guess because I already know the answer, but...
Damn it.
Well, I don't know. Let's try just for a sec. Maybe the weather wasn't good that day.
Yeah, something like that. Actually, it turns out that for some reason, Street Fighter V conflicts with Wacom pen outlet drivers, which means that anybody who is an illustrator who is trying to play Street Fighter is not able to play Street Fighter. So this is one of the reasons why Yukatibia and I don't bother with PC gaming, because we don't have time for this shit. And lastly, in the follow-up, a friend of the show, Kanye West, launched his album The Life of Pablo on Saturday night during his Saturday Night Live performance. And the album was on sale for a few hours on KanyeWest.com, but then was suddenly pulled. And now, apparently, it is a title exclusive that will never, ever be on Apple. Quote from Kanye West, a friend of the show. And
back that off, please.
Close personal friend. Okay. Greatest rapper alive.
You want to kill me tonight.
I could go into great detail about all of the awesome things he says on that album, but I won't. Tidal has since been the number one app in North America and probably in other countries, but I was too lazy to go check every single app store. And I think it's kind of interesting to consider what Kanye is doing because, well, first of all, it's completely insane, but that's sort of normal because that's sort of what he's been doing this week on Twitter. But I'm kind of uncomfortable with the direction that Kanye is taking because basically he said, his album is going to be exclusive to Tidal and all of his future Good Fridays music. So Kanye does this thing called Good Fridays. He's been doing this for like his last two albums, I think, where every Friday he posts a new song on his website. And eventually some of those actually wind up on the albums. Some of them don't. But he just basically puts out a song every Friday. And he is going to be making all future Good Fridays releases also exclusive to Tidal. And he says he has approximately 80 songs right now recorded for this project, which is kind of a lot. So how do we feel about Kanye's music being streaming only? It's sort of like the opposite of Taylor Swift's move to go basically and say, I'm only streaming this on Apple Music with 1989.
How do I feel about it, to be honest?
Well, you don't like Kanye's music, so you probably don't care.
Sure, I was about to say that I don't have $1 billion to finance his idea, so I do not have any opinion about it, because if I don't have $1 billion, I don't have opinion.
All right. As someone who does a little bit of DJing on the side, I'm actually sort of disappointed that there is no way to buy the album at all anymore. I mean, I was awake during the few hours it was up for sale, and now I regret not buying it. But basically, now there is no way to own Kanye's album at all. And that is very strange and not something I expected. And I'm not going to be paying for a Tidal subscription just so I can listen to Kanye's album from time to time. It seems like a bad use of my money. And I would rather just pay, like, originally the price of his album was $20, which is quite a lot for an album, especially digital. But if it's a really good album, I'll pay for it. But now that possibility has just gone away. So very strange. But that's it for today's follow-up.
Oh, I did forget to mention something regarding follow-up before the show.
Oh.
Is during the last 2 weeks, I was able to finish Ocean Horn.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's in the end, I won't say that you need to judge the time it took me to do it as golden. Like, I'm pretty bad at most games, so, and also slow. But it took me, including this new island, which is kind of part of an update that got released a year ago, but the original story took me like 15 hours to do, and add maybe an hour or two to complete the side quest island.
That's actually a surprising length for an iOS game.
It is, and it surprised me a lot because you can still see the... And it's pretty easy to see how much time you spent in your own save game. And I was surprised... Like, I wasn't surprised for it because it was an Apple TV game because, like, I'm used to longer games on consoles. But now that I was reminded, like, yeah, this game was launched on iOS first. 15 hours on your iOS device is pretty long. Like, can you imagine holding those devices for 15 hours and play? Obviously, battery will die at some point, but the fact they were able to capture the attention of people for this amount of time on iOS is pretty amazing.
Yep. All right. Next up, we are bringing back a segment that we debuted a couple of months ago, Tales from the Enterprise.
Yes.
And this week, I'm going to be talking about LINQ, Language Integrated Query.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, that's your topic tonight?
Yes, it is.
Ah, okay.
God bless LINQ. For those who are not aware, LINQ stands for Language Integrated Query, and what it basically allows you to do is have one universal method of accessing and querying data sets, no matter where they came from. They can come from a database. They can be just a list of items you have in your application within memory. And you can build custom adapters if you want to really be a masochist, I guess. But what's really cool about it is you don't need to write SQL anymore. You can just write directly to this API, which in many circumstances is much, much, much more concise than SQL. And for simple things, it is much easier to grasp than SQL and a lot less trouble to do. And I've been using LINQ extensively because more or less like half the code I write, it accesses database stuff in some way or another. And it's really nice to be able to write this really expressive code. And then behind the scenes, all of that is done lazily. So it compiles down to the most optimal, in theory, SQL behind the scenes. And then your database query should be really, really fast, even though your code is really expressive. And anyone who has done basically anything complex in SQL knows that if you want to write things in a way that is clear and maintainable, very often that does not actually result in code that is going to perform very well. So it's really, really nice to have LINQ basically offer this common layer that can be used in the same way, regardless of which database you're accessing, more or less. There are certain exceptions with regards to what functions you're allowed to call in your queries, because those are directly dependent on what is compatible with the database driver. But for the most part, you can basically write the same code, and it doesn't matter if you're interacting with stuff that's in memory, with stuff that's on an Oracle database, with stuff that's on an SQL server database, and it's miraculous. And I think that is probably the number one thing that .NET developers coming to something like Objective-C or Swift want out of the language. They miss the power of LINQ. And I know that we briefly did some .NET stuff in college, and we used LINQ in our project, and it was really, really awesome. And then coming back to Objective-C and having to deal with either a SQLite or a Core Data, I mean, it's not to say that those things are painful, but it certainly isn't as smooth and as expressive as Link was.
Yeah, I think the point is the smoothness of it. Especially in the last 6 months, we started to use Cordata pretty heavily in our project at work. And there's tools these days to make Cordata more smooth in your code base, but nothing as smooth as Link.
Yep. There is one downside to Link, though, and that is it's only useful within the context of .NET development. The problem is, very often, I still have to go into SQL Server's management tools and go do stuff manually in the database, and then I have to remember what the syntax is in SQL and go back and forth several times a day between writing Link, writing SQL, writing Link, writing SQL. It would be lovely if, at the very least, SQL Server directly supported Link, so that .NET developers that are fully baked into the Microsoft stack can just go ahead and learn Link once and not have to bother with SQL. The problem is there are certain things that are just completely funky to do in Link when you want to do really complex stuff, like non-standard inner joins. I keep forgetting how to do those, and it's really not intuitive how to do those. But again, for the really basic stuff that you do, your bread and butter tasks that you do with a database, Link is just the best way to do it, I think. And it would be really, really nice if maybe Cordata or the Swift language could support something like this at some day.
Yeah, I've seen extension that people build on top of NS predicate and stuff to closely resemble to what a Link does in the .NET environment, but nothing like as, I won't say as perfect, but as close as it is right now. There's always missing one feature that is part of the basic feature set of Link that those other tools on other languages don't have. And you're like, oh, I need it once. Even if it's part of the basic feature set, I need it once, and now it's not part of this other tool chain, and you miss it.
Yep. So big thanks to our sponsor, Microsoft, who is sponsoring this segment because we say nice things about their product. Next up is something a little bit atypical for me. I'm going to recommend an application, which has nothing to do with the main topic, except
nice.
I want people to go check out this app. So you might not be familiar with the company Serato, unless you're a DJ, but Serato is a big name in the DJ community. They made some of the best digital vinyl system software, which let you play MP3s, basically, on a vinyl turntable and simulate scratch effects with real vinyl. That software was called Scratch Live, and it was huge back in the day. In fact, still huge. They make Serato DJ, which is the DJing app that I love above all others on the Mac. And on Monday...
Is it the one still not compatible with El Capitan?
No, they finally fixed it. It took like Ooh. 8 months, but they fixed it. Thank God. But I'm still not on El Capitan. But that's another subject. So on Monday, they released this application called Pyro, which came completely out of nowhere. I don't think anyone was expecting them to come out with this. And this is an app that does not target DJs, which is surprising for a company that does basically audio production software and DJ software. But it is an auto-mixing music player for your local music library and for Spotify. And it's so close to being the perfect music player on iOS that I urge you to go check it out.
Unless you're an Apple Music subscriber, I would guess.
Yeah, unless you're on Apple Music. If you're on Apple Music, I'm sorry. So the first third of the screen at the top, there's a now playing track, there's a play pause button and a skip button. And then the bottom two thirds of the screen are just basically your upcoming songs in the playlist. And what's really great about this is, first of all, you can drag and drop songs directly in the list. It's not a modal thing. You can just swipe a little tiny bit and then drag up and down along the playlist if you want to reorder songs, which is great. You can swipe away songs that you want to delete from the playlist. It feels a lot like I guess sort of like Mailbox or like Clear, those kinds of apps which have fancy designed UIs with lots of gestures. It very much feels like that, but the music app equivalent of that. And at the very bottom of the playlist, there are dynamic recommendations that are based on your recently played tracks. And basically, if you put your songs in a playlist and they are within a certain percentage of BPM from each other, at the end of the song, Serato Pyro will automatically beat match the songs together and fade from one to the other seamlessly, which is better than iTunes cross-dissolve, which is basically just we're not even going to attempt to match the BPMs on these things. We're just going to cross dissolve the two tracks together, which can lead to some really weird clashing sometimes if you use that feature. But if you use Serato Pyro, the blending is much more seamless. That's not to say it's perfect, because of course it analyzes the beats with an algorithm, and sometimes the algorithm can be wrong, and DJ software will often give you tools to correct the analysis that was wrong. But since Pyro is very much targeting the end user, there are no such customizations to the beat grid and to the, all that stuff. And besides, most people probably aren't going to bother. But I've been very impressed with the results. The one thing I would actually enjoy if they did this is there is a competing DJ software company, Native Instruments, who does Traktor DJ on the iPad. And what's great about Traktor DJ is it analyzes your whole library. And if you tap on a track, you get ordered recommendations, which are done via the key and the BPM. So you can get really, really good matches that not only have a close BPM, but the music harmonizes together when you're switching from one song to the other. And I have done some crazy mixes that people have wondered how I got the songs to blend. And the way I got the songs to blend is I looked at Traktor DJ on the iPad and I just wrote down the recommendations from one track to another. So it's really good for making harmonic mixes like that. And unfortunately, from what I can tell, Serato Pyro doesn't do harmonic mixing yet. That's a question mark. But in theory, Spotify's music database has all that information. So you could do it with basically all the music on Earth. You could randomly have a really good harmonics mix of whatever genre you enjoy, theoretically. Or you can try to recreate the same thing with smart playlists in iTunes combined with Pyro. This has been my soundtrack for most of the work week so far, and I've been really enjoying it. It's free, so go check it out. Serato Pyro, that's Serato Pyro, Pyro, on the App Store. It's currently not an Android, but if you're an Android user, you're probably not listening to this podcast.
All right.
Now we can move on to the main topic.
Good.
So 2 weeks ago when we were doing the, actually not 2 weeks ago, a month ago when we were doing my last episode on my gaming setup, I had just purchased an iPad Pro.
Ooh.
And I basically had touched it for 15 to 20 minutes at that time, so I couldn't really give any commentary on it, and I'm going to do it now. I'm also going to talk about how I've been using the Apple Watch more at my day job. Because my usage has picked up significantly recently, and I think that not enough people are talking about how the Apple Watch is useful when it works in work contexts, and I'd like to introduce you to some of what I use the Apple Watch for in my day-to-day life. But let's start with the iPad Pro. The iPad Pro is the first iPad I've owned that completely supports the iOS multitasking features that were introduced during iOS 9. So iOS 9, if you had an iPad Air, which is what I had previously, you could only do slide over, which let you have basically iPhone-sized apps docked on the right side of the screen as an overlay on top of another app. But you couldn't have two apps on screen side by side running at once. So the iPad Pro is my first experience of that, and it's actually really, really great. You get basically about three quarters of a portrait iPad Air view for each application when you're using them 50-50. But I would say that so far I basically haven't been using many apps 50-50. More often than not, I'm just running whatever app on the left and Tweetbot as a single column on the right because I'm addicted to Twitter. And that's basically how I've been running my Mac all the time anyway. So now it just lets me recreate that setup on the iPad, which is really cool. Another thing that is really great, this I did have on the iPad Air, but it is much more enjoyable on a bigger screen, is picture-in-picture, which unfortunately YouTube does not support. And
that's my main problem with picture-in-picture. It's like most content provider that I use on the iPad does not support it.
So Twitch, God bless their hearts, they updated their app on day one, and it has always supported picture-in-picture, which is awesome. But YouTube, of course, and Google as a whole, as it's become somewhat of a meme that Google Docs will never be updated for iOS multitasking.
And the bigger joke regarding the YouTube app is it's not even using the full resolution of the iPad Pro. It's the scaled app.
Right, it's still scaled. Google is basically lagging behind on so many fronts with their iOS apps. And like I tweeted about this a little earlier, I use Hangouts to talk to basically two people, and I go into it a couple times a day. And twice a week, it will throw me to the first run tutorial and log me out completely. I continue to get the notifications in the background, but I still get kicked out to the tutorial and have to log back in and then get all of the tooltips that say, hey, do you want to review our app? Hey, did you know about this trick? Yes, I do. I've done your tutorial twice this week. So yeah, Google Apps on iOS, I don't know how people deal with this shit regularly. The YouTube app, you don't really have a choice to use it because third-party clients are sort of frowned upon by Google. But if you want to do picture-in-picture, there is a neat little app called PipTube, which I think is still up on the App Store, that I've been using to do third-party, sort of not really legit picture-in-picture with YouTube. But it works, so I'm not going to complain.
So you use this app without the YouTube app installed. So you can, like, I'm guessing if I recall correctly, this app is also an extension. So you can extension this link. Like, if you're on Safari browsing, you can just say, like,
PipTube doesn't have the extension. There is another app that does have the extension, but I didn't. Basically, I had already purchased PipTube, so I'm sticking with it. What it does have is a widget that you can put in the Today view. So I just swipe down from the top of the screen with a YouTube URL on my clipboard and tap it, and it opens the video and picture in picture, which is pretty useful. My opinion on iOS multitasking has somewhat changed due to the iPad Pro, and the reason for that is because of the, I guess it's not really 30%, but I want to say like the 320 pixel width view or the iPhone view or what developers would know as a compact width size class view. So basically, when you make your application on the right side of the screen take about the same width as an iPhone app would normally, certain apps will behave completely differently in this mode. A good example of this is Procreate, which is a drawing application, a raster drawing application. If you're using it in complete 50-50, it's the full application. It's exactly the same as if you were running it on an iPad Air in portrait. If you use the shorter view, which looks more like a really, really tall iPhone, it becomes a viewer, and it doesn't actually let you do anything except zoom in and out of your existing drawing, but you can only look at it. You can't edit at all. And that actually was the first time I realized that this is going to impact how people design their applications. The fact that you basically have to, even if your app only targets the iPad, you basically have to make an iPhone app now if you want to support multitasking as well. And I think that's going to have two consequences. The first thing is, I fear that people aren't going to be targeting necessarily features that would make more sense on a bigger screen device, and they're only going to be targeting the set of features that would also work well on a small screen like the iPhone. And that would mean that we would get less powerful apps on the iPad. We would get more iPad apps, but they would be less powerful because they would effectively be limited to what is possible on the phone because they want all of the features of their apps to be accessible in the phone width of their app on the iPad. That is a really long run-on sentence that probably didn't make much sense. But I'm just worried of what this is going to cause in app design, the trends that this is going to cause in app design, because now everybody has to make an iPhone size for their apps if they want to support iOS multitasking.
And I think the best example of that is, yet again, YouTube, especially in the recent updates, is the UI, even if it uses the whole resolution of an iPad, feels like an iPhone UI blown up to the iPad.
Very much.
And at this point, it's just easy to say, I have a list. Now I've more space to show elements on the screen. I can maybe change the way that my elements are displayed, but in the end, it's just a giant list on the iPad. And in a way, that's kind of easy to do. Is it the right approach? Maybe, maybe not. But it might not be the optimized approach for the iPad experience, but it works.
And one of the things that was touted very heavily during the launch of the iPad is apps should be designed differently for a bigger screen than a little screen. But now, since you can change the context in which your application is running dynamically, you sort of want to maintain some consistency in what the user interface looks like to avoid having basically a completely different user interface and complete confusion when you switch from one to the other. And I think that stuff like Twitter for iPad, back when it was basically Tweety, when Lauren Brichter made this amazing Twitter client for the iPad, that wouldn't work boiled down to a little tiny 320 pixel width column. And I think we're going to be missing out on more innovative types of applications because people are going to feel like, well, I have to sort of do something that's common to both sizes of my application, instead of experimenting with stuff that works well in a small screen and stuff that works well in a big screen.
I think the main problem would be more that people will take the lazy route.
Definitely.
And that is expected if you want to ship your product early, and that's fine. It's just that it disincentivizes people of doing like iPad optimized experiences, which they were already not doing.
And if you want to be entirely pragmatic, and we'll get back to this a little later, iPad sales are still going down despite the iPad Pro, and it doesn't really make sense to be focusing all your effort on designing an iPad app when you could be designing an iPhone app that also happens to support the iPad relatively okay. And I think that's the approach that many developers are going to be taking, and I think that's a risk for the iPad Pro success because certain types of apps just aren't going to happen. All right, next up, let's talk about the touch keyboard. I did not buy the smart keyboard mostly because I love the touch keyboard in iOS, or at least I did before the iPad Pro, and now I really don't like this new keyboard. It's hard to get used to, and
it is.
And I think that a lot of the things that made the original iOS touch keyboard on the iPad really great are just not here. The original iOS keyboards on phones before the iPhone 6 and iPads before the iPad Pro were only the essentials by default. Only the essentials were visible on screen. Your keys, your letter keys, went to the edge of the screen, so you had extra Fitts' law stuff going on where your tap zones for the edges were bigger than what you expected. And this allowed us to be really sloppy when typing, and autocorrect, if you haven't enabled, which you should do because you're not a stupid person, autocorrect will fix everything in the end, mostly. The problem is that starting with the iPhone 6 bigger screen and to a greater extent, the iPad Pro, in certain contexts now you've got new buttons on the edges of the places where you were normally typing. And this actually means that, for example, if you're typing the leftmost and rightmost keys on what used to be the old keyboard, so the Q, the A, the Z, and the P, the L, and, I guess technically the period, you are going to be experiencing smaller tap zones than you expect for those things because they are no longer at the edge. There is a button next to them now, and you are going to be hitting that button more often than you'd like. And this is one of the reasons that I completely stopped typing in landscape at all on my iPhone, is I can't get used to the new tap zones on the landscape keyboard on my iPhone 6.
And I was just about to mention this example, like the iPhone 6 keyboard on portrait is like the old one. But in landscape, it fudged all of the normal keys in the middle. And it seems to me that the keys are maybe a little bit smaller. Or it's just that we're so used to them being bigger in landscape than portrait. Then now that when they are about the same size in either orientation, it's just that when it's landscape, there's other keys on the side.
Yeah.
Which you always press.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's unusable, basically. And on the iPad, it's not as bad because you're not thumb typing on it. Most of the time, you're going to be using it more like a laptop keyboard. But you're still going to miss hit because there's no physical feedback. And I would rather have less keys on the keyboard and type better than have more keys on the keyboard that I was never interested in having in the first place, and then accidentally screwing up my stuff all the time. What makes matters worse is that a lot of the keys on the edges are actually destructive to the autocorrect process. So there's a tab key now. I've never wanted to type a tab character on my iPad ever, but there's a tab key now. If I hit the tab key, well, it's going to enter a tab, and autocorrect is not going to consider that in the same way that it would consider another letter, for example. Punctuation is also slightly more destructive to what the possible corrections of autocorrect are So autocorrect quality goes down. And if autocorrect quality goes down, typing speed goes down, because the entire reason people can type so fast on iOS is because you have to trust that the autocorrect is going to do its job correctly. And you can't trust that it's going to do its job correctly anymore because you keep nudging these stupid fucking keys on the side because they're there now and they weren't there before. There is an extra problem with this because I use the English and Japanese keyboards in harmony. And apparently I didn't know about this until I enabled the Japanese keyboard. As soon as you add the Japanese keyboard to one of your possible options, the tab button becomes a button to switch between English and Japanese keyboard, which is terrible because when I mistap the Q and I press the switch to Japanese keyboard button, suddenly everything I'm typing is Japanese gibberish, which is not what I want to be typing. And I really don't understand. Well, I sort of understand in big air quotes why it's there, because Japanese physical keyboards have this key to switch, but it's not there. It's not at the tab key. It's where the right command and option keys are normally on a Mac keyboard. That's where the language switch key is normally. But there's already the international key to switch keyboards in the bottom left side of the keyboard, where it's not in the way and I'm not going to accidentally tap it when I'm typing. But now, because there's a stupid tab key and it becomes an English-Japanese switch key for me, I am just typing gibberish all the time. It's incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, it's surprising because... excuse me. So, yeah, it was surprising because the tab key right now on the iPad Pro that I have with me is the tab key, even if I'm in French or English. So it seems to be a feature that is only kind of quote-unquote available when you enable the Japanese keyboard or maybe other Asian keyboard.
Yeah, it's probably any Asian keyboard that has a input switch key on a physical keyboard that the tab key gets switched over that key. It would make sense. I'm not sure of all of them. I imagine Chinese is the same and maybe Korean. Those are usually the big suspects.
Right now, the main problem that I have with the virtual keyboard on the iPad Pro is the fifth row, the smaller one with the numbers.
Oh, I hate that too.
And it's not the numbers, it's the delete key is now part of this row.
And it's much, much smaller than the delete key used to be, so now it's harder to tap it.
Exactly. And the numbers are fine. I find myself using it a lot, and I love that I don't have to switch to using the 123 button. But delete key, the fact that it's just longer and really, really, really thin, this is a problem.
Yeah, it's... I hadn't even noted that down, but yeah, it's a problem. Another thing that is a problem is the keyboard tries to mimic a laptop keyboard layout. And this is good if you're switching from a laptop. It's bad if you're switching from the old iPad. And one reason for this is iPad power users might know that if you swipe up on certain keys, you get quick shortcuts. Now you can't swipe up on those keys anymore because the key isn't in the same place as you expected it to be. So one of the examples of this is previously on the period key, you could swipe up and get an apostrophe on an iPad Air. On the iPad Pro, there is now a dedicated apostrophe key, so swiping up on the period key does not actually do that. And all of your muscle memory for the shortcuts that you have learned about typing on an iPad for the past 6 years are basically gone. So have fun relearning how to type on your iPad. There are two other things I'd like to bring up with regards to the keyboard. The first is that they removed the split keyboard on the iPad Pro, and it's only on the iPad Pro. It's still around on the old iPads. Unclear why, because this is probably the one that needs it the most. And it's not like the split keyboard was good in the first place. It's always been bad, but it would be better to have a split keyboard than have no split keyboard. And I tried to go look at third-party keyboards, because I know that SwiftKey on Android tablets, back when Android tablets were just starting to be a thing, was phenomenal. It was easily the best split keyboard I've ever used on a touch device ever. And I wanted to use that on iOS, so I downloaded the SwiftKey app, and the SwiftKey app on iOS does not have a split keyboard for no reason I can really discern. So that's kind of a problem. There appears to be exactly zero split keyboards on the App Store right now. So I'm trying to develop my own for my own enjoyment that basically mimics the iPad Air keyboard in portraits dimensions, because I'm used to thumb typing on that one. And I'll see how it goes when I'm done playing around with those APIs. But yeah, I'm really not satisfied with the state of the keyboard on the iPad Pro, which is unfortunate because this is sort of supposed to be the productivity device. And more keys does not necessarily equate to more productive. All right, next up, I'm going to talk about Apple Pencil.
Oh, maybe before you go, I can speak a bit about the Smart Keyboard.
Oh, sure. I didn't even know you had that.
Yeah, I do. So when you reminded me that this week you wanted to do an episode about the iPad Pro, it was, what, 2 weeks ago that you did that? We just received our Smart Keyboard for our QA iPad Pro device. So I gladly ask our QE people to make sure that I can use it for my personal use for a couple of weeks. And that's what I've been doing for the last 2 weeks. And to be honest, though, I haven't used that much the virtual keyboard for the only usage I did. My main gripe was related to delete key. And I was pretty surprised by the Smart Keyboard. And the Smart Keyboard is a little bit weird. Like, it is part of the Smart Cover, and it's kind of a plasticky feeling. And the most complaint I've saw is twofold. The first one is the key travel is pretty small, which I got used to, so I don't have anything to say about it except that for an iPad keyboard, that's fine. And the other one is that the layout is US English, which I don't mind, but I would see, like, if I were to speak type French stuff on the keyboard all day long, I wouldn't mind to have a French Canadian keyboard layout. But from what we heard, and maybe rumors said, that they might be bringing those new layouts in the near future. Don't know why it was shipped this way first, but they decided to ship the US layout internationally at first, and then they will ship new one later on. Strange decision to me. But the keyboard by itself is pretty nice. The main part I enjoy the most is, especially if you have a long, strong password, I stop using Touch ID. Like, it is enabled, but I'm so used to press spacebar and stop typing my password, like I'm used to do on the Mac, that this feels so much easier to do than just leaving my hand from the keyboard and pressing the Touch ID sensor.
Yeah, I completely forgot to write about Touch ID on my notes, but yeah, I've been loving Touch ID on the iPad Pro because, unlike my phone, it actually recognizes my finger. So it's actually usable.
Which is surprising because for you, it is the same sensor. But for me, my sensor is better on my phone.
Yeah, but I've been really enjoying using Touch ID for all of the login stuff that's been made a lot easier on the iPad. And I like it because it actually works, unlike on my phone where it basically never worked.
Small tangent. By the way, for the last week, my Touch ID sensor is kind of acting up a bit. So maybe I'll have to check a bit. Like, it feels to me that the first try is always unsuccessful. And I'm like, oh, maybe I did something wrong. And then press again, and it worked.
Strange.
It is. But yeah, if we go back to the Smart Keyboard, the fact that it's doesn't use any batteries, because the last external keyboard that I used was either an Apple Bluetooth one or another, like, kind of a keyboard Bluetooth case, which was kind of a pain to use first because it was really small, and second of all, the Bluetooth connection wasn't that great. So the Smart Connector on the iPad Pro is a big plus. You just don't need to care about it. The system detects it the second it is plugged in into the iPad. So it's been a while since I've seen the virtual keyboard because of it.
Yeah, I just have no interest in using an external keyboard, so I haven't really even considered getting one. One of the funny things about the Smart Connector, though, is I was running my fingers along the side of my iPad, and I was like, what the hell is this? Why is there a SIM card slot on my iPad? This isn't a cellular iPad. And then I realized, oh, wait, that's the Smart Connector.
Oh, yeah. And in a way, I kind of wish it was my personal iPad and not at the same time, because I would have tried the Logitech Create keyboard because it seems pretty interesting, especially compared to this Smart Keyboard. And they are selling it for about the same price or maybe a little bit more expensive. But to me, the Logitech Create feels like a better product. The keys looks and the layout looks more like a traditional keyboard and not something that is like in plastic. Like, it's kind of the way to describe the material they use is kind of all of those like waterproof plastic to make sure that everything is spill proof. And it's kind of plasticky rubbery, so it feels weird to type on it compared to a normal keyboard. And the other feature that I would like to use on the Logitech Crit is that the keyboard is backlit. And I know that you're not a big fan of backlit keyboards, but I am.
All right.
Apple Pencil. Which I don't have, so I'm really happy to see what you'll have to say about.
Awesome. CGP Gray on the Cortex podcast basically gave his review of the Apple Pencil and called it the first stylus to be acceptable. And the joke on the podcast was they're going to make billboards now that just say acceptable CGP Gray and then a big picture of the Apple Pencil. And I agree with that statement. So first of all, I do have experience with Wacom pen tablets. I've been using a Wacom pen tablet as a pointing device for my computer since last fall because my RSI had gotten out of control and I had to do something about it. And I couldn't use the trackpad anymore or anything. It was just hurting too badly. So I switched to a Wacom pen tablet. And now I basically don't use my Mac anymore, more or less. So it's not even an issue anymore for my RSI. But in terms of how it feels to hold in your hand, I feel like Wacom pen tablet, Wacom styluses typically feel more like bulky pens. And Apple Pencil is called Apple Pencil because it feels like a pencil. It also acts like a pencil in certain cases, and we'll get into that a little bit. And you can't really talk about styluses and input devices without talking about latency. And latency is something that is very near and dear to iOS nerds' heart because one of the reasons why iOS is so much better than Android in our eyes is how responsive the operating system feels to user input. And the problem usually with styli and all that stuff is there is visible latency between the input that you are doing and what appears on the screen. I found the latency on the Apple Pencil varies wildly from one app to the other. It's very inconsistent. So if you go into the Notes app, which is probably going to be the most optimal implementation of the Apple Pencil because it was made by Apple, it's incredibly responsive and I can't really detect any latency of any kind. I'm sure it's there if you use a really slow motion camera and film the thing. It has to be there because it's technology, it's not flawless. But then you switch to Procreate and latency is visible to the naked eye with many brushes in regular usage, despite the app actually being updated and having explicit support for the Apple Pencil. Now, naturally, I understand that Procreate is doing a lot more computation behind the scenes to A, simulate a brush stroke, B, manage the 12 other layers I have under there and their blend modes and all of that stuff while I'm drawing the thing. So for everything it's actually doing, it's very respectable latency time, but it's still visible to the naked eye, and that sort of bugs me because I'm a horrible person. It feels really good to use, but ultimately the Apple Pencil, the problem is it doesn't actually make you a worthwhile artist. I'm still shit at drawing, even though I have an Apple Pencil, which is unfortunate because I was hoping I was going to turn into like fucking Pablo Picasso.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So I really like the Apple Pencil. I'm going to be using it more for note-taking than for drawing, probably, but I have been drawing more since I got it, because why not? I mean, I have it, so might as well use it for something. But I haven't actually found a note-taking app that I like, which is an issue. My entire notes workflow right now is in a transition period where I'm sort of floating between a bunch of stuff, and nothing feels right yet, so that's unfortunate, but yeah.
Yeah, the best example of the Apple Pencil being used that I've seen like in front of my face is some of my colleagues use it as a quote-unquote whiteboard.
Yeah.
On the Notes app. And it's amazing at doing so on the Notes app. Like, we want to discuss about something regarding maybe code design, like placement with the designer on some UI. Just use the iPad Pro, start to draw, and it just works.
Yeah, and the work that I do at my day job is very confidential, so we're not actually allowed to leave paper on our desk because the cleaning person could actually look at it. That's not a joke. And so I've been tempted several times to bring my iPad Pro into work with the Apple Pencil and just take notes in there, and then I can bring those notes with me instead of leaving a piece of paper on my desk and have the risk of having someone read it. I don't actually think they would read it, but I'd rather have those notes with me and in a digital form where I don't have piles of paper all the time. And surely I would remember things more that way than I currently do, which is asking my coworkers the same question 5 times in a row across the day. That doesn't really scale well. So yeah, I'm probably going to start doing that pretty soon, especially as we get into more meatier part of the project.
In the last few days, I started to use my Cosmonaut back. And the Cosmonaut was one of those like stylus for the old screen, quote unquote. And it was pretty optimized for the first iPad, to be honest. It felt to me that since they move like on, since Apple started to use like thinner glass for the screen, it felt that its precision was diminishing a bit. And for the fun of it, I decided to try it back on the iPad Pro. And I don't think I was able to obviously see any advantages over the Apple Princess on the precision-wise. But even with the new like predictive technology that is part of the iOS SDKs, like it felt to me that even those old pencil styluses are still a hit or miss.
Yeah, well, they can only do a certain degree of quality, right? I mean, the Cosmonaut, one of the big design goals for the Cosmonaut is we're unapologetically trying to emulate a finger, except with this big crayon-looking thing. Whereas a lot of different styluses were trying to be more pencil-like or pen-like and failed because they weren't really able to do a very good job of it.
I wouldn't say it was trying to emulate a finger. More it was trying to emulate dry eraser pens.
Yeah.
Or pen. And that's the feeling you always got. And when you switch your thinking to say like, oh, imagine I was drawing on a whiteboard. It works not flawlessly, but like 95% of the time it was working as you expected it.
Yeah. Two quick notes. I mentioned that Apple Pencil is called Apple Pencil because it looks like a pencil. It also acts like a pencil. So you can write really, really small with the Apple Pencil, and it works remarkably well. And I heard Mike Hurley say that on one of his podcasts, and I didn't believe him. And then I tried it, and it's actually true. So you can write really, really small with the Apple Pencil, and it works surprisingly well. It works much better in the Notes app than in something like Procreate, which is more of a drawing application, so it doesn't really handle that case as well. But it works, and it's really impressive. The other thing is applications can now basically detect, I'm not really good at explaining the terminology because I'm not an actual artist, but if you use the side of the pencil to basically like
brush in a way?
Yeah, sort of like brushing graphite into your paper drawing. If you basically try to do that with the pencil in a supported application, it works and it tries to recreate basically the orientation of the pencil and what that effect would be like on a piece of paper, which is really interesting. And I don't think that is something Wacom tablets can do for the most part. Maybe some really pro models can, but this is like $100 add-on for your iPad, and it does the job remarkably well and maybe even better than most tablets on the market. And that seems to be the big conclusion that all of the artists are coming to. The people with actual talent, unlike me, seem to be saying this, and I have no trouble believing it. So it's really, really cool. I still haven't actually emptied the battery on my Apple Pencil, so I haven't had the chance to plug it in directly into the iPad and hold it up like a sign.
And do a protest.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a question regarding your usage of the Apple Pencil.
Sure.
Do you use it to navigate, like interact with normal UIKit controls and not only note-taking or drawing?
No, I don't. And I know this is like the big topic these days because iOS 9.3 beta does not support you using the Apple Pencil to manipulate on-screen control of all kinds. It only works in basically drawing contexts in 9.3. And I'm not sure how it tells the difference, but okay. And I know that on the last episode of Cortex on the Relay FM network, there was a huge rant by Mike Hurley and CGP Grey about how they actually rely on this for their RSI issues. And I don't really experience RSI issues with the iPad, and I prefer using my finger to hit finger-sized targets. So I am basically in line with Apple's philosophy for the iPad. the iPad Pro and the Apple Pencil, and I just use it like they originally intended it to be. However, I am fully receptive to their message that it is, at the very least, it's an accessibility feature that should be in the operating system for accessibility reasons, and that Apple shouldn't be removing this functionality altogether.
I would be interested to know, and I'm sure nobody will have the sensor, but it would be interesting to know if, like, using the Apple Pencil to interact with touch controls was something they added originally, or was just like a side effect of the Pencil. So the Pencil was able to just work, and it just worked. So are they now adding code to disable it, or they are removing code that they put in the OS to disable? And I'm sure in the, like, in the long run, we won't care about it, but it will feel that if it was either one or the other option, that it, Apple had the vision or message regarding Apple Pencil, and this message has now changed internally.
I'm not entirely sure that the message has changed. I think that the message has always been the same, and that they are just now applying it more strictly than they did in the original version. All right, next up I want to talk about last episode of the podcast, because last episode of the podcast was edited on my iPad Pro.
Ooh!
Yeah, big reveal. And there was a tell for this, you could have told, because the pace of the previous episode was much slower than what you've probably heard us sounding like before, and you probably didn't realize this if you were using Overcast, because Overcast has smart speed, and we basically bake smart speed into our MP3s that we ship to other people normally. However, due to the workflow that I'm going to explain, it wasn't really possible for me to do this on the iPad without significant amount of work. So episode 33 was mostly edited on the iPad with an application called Fairite Recording Studio. And I say mostly because, as we've explained previously, we record on Piezo on the Mac, and my voice is on the left channel and Nukodivia's voice is on the right channel, and we need to be able to split this stuff. And until midway last week, there wasn't an update to Fairite that lets you split those channels. But now it's possible, so in theory, I should be able to edit the entire podcast this week on my iPad, and I will try that out.
And it was kind of part of the reason why we decided to pick back Fairite to try it again, because originally, I think maybe 2 or 3 months ago when you tried it, it was not part of the feature set. But recently it was announced that it was coming, and then it picks up our curiosity again.
Yeah. So Fairite is interesting because it's an application that was actually tested by podcasters before it was shipped, and they gave feedback on it. And as a result, it is very tailored to Jason Snell's personal workflow. And that's not a diss on Jason Snell. He's a great guy. But our workflow, or at least my workflow, is very different from his. And I am running into a lot of issues trying to adapt my workflow style to the way the tool is built. It's very much an opinionated app in that way, in that it's not a, well, I guess you could technically use it as a general purpose audio editor, but it tries to guide you in a certain path. And if you try to stray away from that path, you're going to have issues. There are gestures in the app. And one of the reasons I need the gestures is because of the strip silence feature. So strip silence, we use a thing called truncate silence in Audacity when we edit this podcast. And that basically cuts out the silence instead of leaving blank holes where the silence is, which is what strip silence does in Fairite. So what this means is you have to manually move the clips together all the time. And if there's a lot of back and forth in the conversation, you will have to move a lot of clips back and forth, back and forth, back and forth to keep the same rhythm. And there isn't really a way to say, I always want the same gap between this person talking and that person talking. You basically have to eyeball it, which is incredibly time consuming. And again, with Audacity, we select a menu option, we press on a button, and all of that is done automatically for us.
I think this means that we need to do more dramatic pauses in our podcast.
I guess. And so Fairite does have a gesture which allows you to automatically select all of the clips to the right of the current clip. Because, of course, you're going to be moving those clips all the time, so you might as well have a gesture to move it. So that gesture, I could not for the life of me tell what it was. And that sort of an issue is when you have gesture-based apps, if you don't tell the user what the gestures are, good luck finding out about them. So it turns out that I had to actually go look up Jason Snell's review of Ferrite, where he actually wrote about the gestures in a paragraph. And that is how I remembered what the gesture was to actually grab all of the clips that the right was. So I consider that a little bit of a design failure that I wasn't able to actually tell, or there was no non-gesture way to actually get to that feature. And
yeah, in a way, if the gesture is the only feature, it's kind of if you already implemented the shortcut and not the long way
right,
of doing that, something. That's my kind of my feeling regarding gesture in iOS is gesture or shortcut. If that's the only way, yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah, I think that was even in the human interface guidelines for a while, was basically never rely on gestures as being the only way to do something. Always have it accessible via a normal way. And I cannot say that is the case for Ferrite's, at the very least, the select all of the clips to the right feature. And who knows, maybe there are a bunch more useful features that are hidden away behind gestures. I just haven't found them yet. And I don't really have the patience to go out and try every single gesture on every bit of interface on screen.
And I think you can replace gesture for force touches on the watch, and you do have the same conversation.
Yeah, definitely. So if this sounds like a bit of a headache, well, unfortunately, this is emblematic of the iPad Pro experience as a whole. Unlike the PC and the Mac, which has several years of mature software built up already to choose from, you might be dealing with a very limited pool of apps that have been tailored to specific workflows, and none of them necessarily fit into how you work. And one of the often suggested workarounds for this is, well, just use a combination of multiple apps to do the things correctly. And there is an app on the App Store which actually does allow us to do truncate silence, exactly how we do in Audacity. There is an app on iOS which allows us to do noise reduction, exactly like we do in Audacity, which Ferrite doesn't do noise reduction, it does noise gating, which is not the same thing. It can give comparable results in certain cases, but not always. So that app that offered all of those advanced audio editing functionality that I wanted was called WavePad. And WavePad is a multi-platform audio editor that has been basically on every computing platform known to man. I think there's probably also an OS 2 version or something. And it's basically one of those weird companies that has this C++ engine for an audio editor that then they continue to pump out on every platform imaginable. So as you can imagine, the app is a UI nightmare. It looks like a Windows 95 app ported to the iPad, and that's because it probably is a Windows 95 app ported to the iPad. But it's incredibly powerful, and it gets the job done. Except the app was never updated to actually support proper inter-app communication stuff, so I can't actually get my audio from Dropbox into WavePad and then out of WavePad into Ferrite. I have to basically shuttle things around with email and iTunes file sharing like it's iOS fucking 4.
Oh, so they use, oh my goodness, they use iTunes file sharing?
Well, there's also a built-in web server where you can upload stuff from other apps. The problem is they didn't update their app for the transport security stuff in iOS 9, so the web server doesn't actually work because it isn't safe enough.
And it gets blocked.
Yeah. So I fell in love with WavePad very, very quickly, and then I was like, yeah, except I can't actually use this for anything because I have to plug it into my Mac to transfer files to it so I can use it. So,
and at this point, Audacity comes back into the picture.
Well, no, I don't need Audacity, but the Mac comes into the picture.
Yeah, but if you're back onto your Mac, you'll just use Audacity for everything, and that's fine.
If I'm going to involve my Mac at all, then I might as well just use the Mac. So it's a really tough sell, the iPad Pro, because if you have an existing iOS workflow you're comfortable with, you are going to love the iPad Pro because it's basically just a bigger and better iPad. If you don't have an existing iOS workflow, you are probably really terrified listening to my story of what this is going to look like for the things you do on your computer that you want to adapt to work on the iPad Pro. And this is going to vary for every single use case. There are some use cases that are nailed down, that there are solid workflows on iOS. But if you are the trailblazer who is getting an iPad Pro, and you have the responsibility of coming up with that workflow, first of all, you're not guaranteed to actually coming up with a workflow that works, because what if there are no apps to do what you need to do? You're screwed. And it might be really, really messy at the end. And if it's too messy, you might just be tempted to keep using a desktop computer. And that brings me, of course, to the declining iPad sales. So I wrote a blog post about this a couple weeks ago, and I'm going to summarize it very quickly. iPad Pro, despite launching last quarter, iPad sales were down by 25%. Not good. And I think there are a couple reasons for that. The first of all is iPhone 6 Plus is eating away at the need for iPads on the low end. So I have encountered this with my own family members. There are people who are saying, I want an iPhone 6 Plus because I want to have one device instead of carrying two devices. And that is basically killing the mini side of the equation of the iPad. But the thing is, as I mentioned earlier, if you're doing the iOS multitasking thing where you're giving a continuum of application from the small screen to the big screen, chances are the app on the iPad Pro and the app on the iPhone 6 Plus are capable of doing the exact same thing. So is it really worth the expense of an iPad Pro to get a bigger screen to do that work on, or are you just going to do it on your phone? And I think for a lot of people, they're just going to stick to their phone, and the iPad Pro doesn't gain market share for that. Then there's customer confidence in the perception of tablets, which I think we've mentioned on a previous episode. But basically, if people have experience with $60 drugstore tablets that run shitty Android 4.0 and have terrible performance, their confidence for what tablets are is very, very low because it's a terrible experience that they've had with tablets. And they generalize that to mean, well, iPads are also shit. And then they don't even consider the iPad. So there's that. And then on a high end, when you have people who are actually considering replacing desktop PCs, laptops, or Macs with an iPad, there's the friction of getting set up on iOS. If you have never done work on iOS, it's not intuitive to just show up on iOS and then try to build these workflows from nothing. You have to, at the very least, be some kind of power user on a computer to have the kind of mentality to figure out these workflows on iOS. And I don't think that most of the people who are going to be targeted by the iPad Pro have that mentality necessarily. And I think that IT departments who are in charge of buying devices for their entire company are going to see a $500 PC laptop, which is capable of doing the exact same workflow they've always had, and they're going to see this $700, $800 iPad Pro that is theoretically capable of being on parity with a PC, except you have to redo everything from scratch, and maybe it'll be slightly more painful, but hey, at least it's a tablet. I think the value proposition of the iPad Pro is incredibly, incredibly low for the markets that the iPad Pro is targeting. And that leaves artists. Artists are going to freak out because it's cheaper than the Cintiq and the Apple Pencil is better than the Wacom tablets. But that's basically their audience right now. And I don't think that's sustainable going forward. All right.
Good. I'm sure you were waiting for me to say something here. And to be honest, though, I don't think I have anything to add. It's the iPad Pro seems promising and rumors were suggesting, like you mentioned, that the decline of numbers were related to those iPad sales that went away. And obviously, we were not able to confirm that because Apple is never releasing like a specific model of iPad sale. But like this 25% can be mostly attributed to iPad minis, and I think they were able to use, like, people were able to use like analytics from website and blah 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 to get percentage number close to what Apple was saying in their latest earnings report. And hopefully in the next quarter, maybe all of those sales for the iPad Pro will just catch up, and then it will. If not, I think it will cause the problem that you mentioned at the beginning of the show, which is like people won't build iPad apps anymore. They'll just build apps that work okay on the iPad for the big market, which is like the iPad market is still big. It is as big as the Mac market, which is kind of surprising, even if it's on decline. The big difference is the iPad market went up really fast and then it's slowly declining compared to the Mac that is just going up and up and up and up at a slow pace. So hopefully maybe what will happen is either it will go fast again or it will just go like the Mac market. And I still think that for all the problem that Yannick faced with Ferrite, there will be other developers that will see those market where people need productivity app or niche app, and then they will just say, okay, I want to build a podcast editor app or an audio app that is marketed not for podcasters, but for DJs, for like people that will create music. And then more people will be able to find a solution to their problem.
And just to be clear, I don't think Ferrite is a bad app. I actually think it's a very good app. It just doesn't mesh with the way that I'm used to working. And that if I was, like Jason Snell, used to working the way that he works, then Ferrite would be my dream app, basically. The problem is, since we're used to doing things a certain way, now we have to work a lot more to achieve the same results that we were getting basically for free on the Mac. And that's not to say there's never going to be a real truncate silence feature built into Ferrite, or it doesn't mean that, for example, WavePad won't get an update that suddenly brings it up to par with inter-app communication stuff in iOS, and then I can just take the file I export from Ferrite, put it into WavePad, and run the truncate silence there, and the problem solved, right? All of that is still possible. The problem is, the people who are trying to buy iPad Pros today don't want to buy it because there's the possibility that something might happen in the future. They care about what it's like now, and now it's kind of a crappy experience.
I want to stay hopeful, to be honest.
Well, if we want to be a little bit more positive, maybe we should end by talking about the Apple Watch, which is surprising because normally those are not the words you would think of when you think of Apple Watch. But
and limitless possibilities. It's kind of a... our negative topic, but from what I heard, you want to be positive about it today.
Yeah, so I use a PC at work because I develop web apps with the ASP.NET MVC, and of course that currently requires a PC to develop for, so I'm stuck on a PC. But I've been...
you could use a Mac with a VM and all law, but well, you're kind of forced
Windows,
to use a PC.
But...
Yeah, but you're kind of forced to use a PC.
Yeah. So I've been relying on the Apple Watch much more heavily during my commute and around the office recently, and I'd like to talk a little bit about how it's been doing that. So 2 weeks ago, we got a new worker on our team who works remotely a couple of cities away from us, and we communicate, the entire development team communicates over Skype, and it's actually really useful to get Skype notifications on my wrist, and because it's not Line, I can actually scroll further. In those notifications instead of seeing like three words, which is useful, especially when I'm wandering around the office or when the team is out to lunch or if I'm stuck in traffic and I need to see to tell my team that I'm going to be late for work. It's really useful. Notifications, we've said it's basically like the number one feature on the Apple Watch, and it's really true because you're going to see that a lot of these things are actually notification related. But they're notifications that actually help me work. So Skype notifications, incredibly useful. Didn't think that it would be that useful, but it is. I use the application Due, D-U-E, for reminders on going to go catch the bus because I take the public transit to work and back. And I like being reminded basically 10 minutes before the bus is supposed to show up. Inevitably, it's always 6 minutes late anyway. But I like to know 10 minutes ahead of time so I can get out the door and get to the bus stop in time.
It's good to know that they kept their 6 minute delay in Trois-Rivières.
Yeah, it's basically always consistently 6 minutes late, except in the morning recently because of the weather and all that stuff. It's been slightly more late recently, but otherwise it's a consistent 6 minutes. So yeah, I use Due for that. In the event that we have a meeting or something, I'll often also put a Due reminder on there. And what I like about Due above other apps, and this is one of the reasons I've been using it since it came out on the iPhone, is it will bug you every minute until you dismiss the reminder. And it's easy sometimes with stuff like alarm clocks, let's say, to put one alarm and then dismiss it and then completely forget about it because you said, hey, I'm going to do this thing later. So what I do with Due is I only really dismiss my alarms once the thing that I've been reminding myself to do is done. So if I haven't done it and then I just neglect it, it'll buzz on my wrist a minute later and a minute later and a minute later until I do it. And the annoyance of having this thing bugging on your wrist every minute is actually a good enough motivator to actually get me to do stuff on time. So that is cool. For general task management, I'm actually finding myself using OmniFocus on the watch quite a bit. And I know you were skeptical of the OmniFocus watch app when we did our original episode on the Apple Watch because it offers a quite a bit of functionality from the iPhone app directly on your wrist. But what's amazing is, especially with the watchOS 2 version of OmniFocus, it's super responsive, which is usually not something you hear when talking about Apple Watch applications. And it, even though it seems like it seemed at the time like it was trying to replicate too much of the iPhone's functionality on the watch, it offers just enough functionality to be useful. You want to be able to see your projects and your contacts. You want to be able to add new items, check things off, but you can't like spend half an hour shuffling your tasks around on your watch. Like, you can't do that, but you can tick things off or look at a list of items really quickly. And I think that's really where it shines. Another thing where it really shines is when you use location reminders. So I can set tasks and say, I have this task, I'm going to do it tomorrow morning, and it's due tomorrow at 5 p.m. Remind me when I get to the office. And I can do that. I can also, when I'm at the office, go to my location list and see, okay, what are the tasks that I have tagged for nearby? And I can see, okay, these are all the things you need to do at the office today. And then when I leave, those tasks disappear from my list, so I don't have to care about them anymore until the next time I'm at the office. So that kind of context awareness is really, really useful, I find. Unfortunately, we use Jira from Atlassian work to manage the tasks on the actual project itself. And I don't necessarily want to replicate all of the tasks that I have in that system on my personal OmniFocus system. So I tend to separate what's really development tasks and keep all of that in Jira where everyone else is working, so I can just maintain one set of tasks. And then everything relating to getting paid or stuff I need to bring to and from the office or stuff like that, all of the non-development related stuff, I'll keep in OmniFocus.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, like, I know in the past I was kind of dismissive of OmniFocus because to my taste, it might be a little bit overkill for my system. But the main reason why I've stopped using it was I left school and most of my work is now either, like you mentioned, in Jira or any issue and like story tracker and just small reminders. Like even the normal reminders on iOS work pretty nice with location aware reminder. Like I really love them, especially if I want to do something, not exactly when I arrive at work, but just to remind me that when I'm about to arrive at work, A, I want to do this. And what I like about what you just said for OmniFocus is since you're able to put a start date and a due date, you can also like get this triggered, like just trigger your brain to remind that you need to do something for today, for example.
Yeah, like for example, every 2 weeks I have to get my invoice approved by my boss. So I want that when I get to the office on the Monday, I can just say, okay, I get to my desk and then I have a notification saying, don't forget to give your invoice to your boss because otherwise you won't get paid at the end of the day, basically. And I can do that so that instead of having a reminder that's manually set, I can just have a recurring reminder every 2 weeks that starts on the Monday. And as soon as I get to work on Monday, that on the recurring things, it'll pop up. And it's reliable that way. Whereas I think reminders isn't necessarily flexible to do those things on a recurring basis exactly how I want. So I think it's really useful for that. Next up is Fantastical. The calendar app on watchOS is actually kind of flawed. Occasionally, it will just refuse to show you all-day items. And I don't know why.
Oh, it's not the only issue with the calendar system on the watch.
Well, okay. But we're trying to be positive here. But
I know.
Occasionally, the watch will just not show all-day items. And one of the things I do with all-day items on my calendaring system is say, today we're starting Sprint 6, and it's going to go on for the next 2 weeks. And I want to be able to look at my calendar and immediately be able to see that next Wednesday is going to be Sprint 7. And I can't do that reliably with the default calendar app. But Fantastical shows it just fine. And that is the main reason why I use the Fantastical app on the Apple Watch. Because, I mean, like, aside from the task adding functionality, which I find the natural language support in Fantastical to be better than what is in the default calendars app. Aside from that, they're basically identical apps, except the Fantastic Owl one functions more reliably and shows all my events. So that's why I use it. I think the complication is a little nicer for Fantastic Owl. I've been using the modular face recently just because there are no real good watch faces on the Apple Watch. So I fall back to modular quite often. If I want to have like a appointment display, it's the only thing that really works.
I think it would be a good idea to not talk about watch faces today because, like you mentioned,
we're trying to stay positive. Yes.
Yeah. I do have a question regarding your calendaring system.
Yeah.
Do you need to have access to either like shared Google calendars or in your any other like shared calendar, which in most cases are from the Google services?
So we have an Exchange server at work, but we don't have it exposed outside of the work network, so I can't actually connect to it on my phone.
Oh, I see. Oh, because my main gripe is related to events that are shared. At some point, if somebody will update the event, it feels that the phone will get the updated event, but it is not properly communicated to your watch. So just for example, like if I had the meeting scheduled for like tomorrow morning, but today somebody like rescheduled it for next week, my watch might buzz tomorrow reminding me, oh, you have a meeting in 10 minutes. Event got like rescheduled.
Yeah. I luckily don't have deal with that since I don't really use shared calendars at all. And as I said, I just recreate my events on my personal calendar on my phone instead of relying on Exchange syncing, because honestly, even if Exchange syncing was available outside of the work network, probably wouldn't do it because I don't like to give that kind of access to my employer on my phone.
Exchange access on your personal phone is kind of a tricky game.
Yeah, and since my office is giving their employees iPhone 5s, I don't really want to downgrade either. Not that I would be eligible for one, since I technically am not an employee. I'm just hired help. So yeah, Fantastic Owl, it works great and more reliably, I find, than the original calendar app. Provided that you use Fantastic Owl everywhere, because, again, watch syncing, as you've just said, it's sort of black magic. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I have found that if I use Fantastic Owl everywhere, everything seems to sync well. Whereas if I just change my events in the stock calendars app, it doesn't work 100% of the time. Then there's just stuff that's built into the operating system. So I am very thankful for stand notifications. Every hour I get buzzed at the 15-minute mark telling me to go stand up. If I haven't, that is certainly less weird to do now in the office, since we can just go walk to the coffee machine instead of running laps around the kitchen table like I used to do back when I worked at home.
Yeah, the stand notifications are my reminder to get water. So I just walk to the water machine, get cold water, and just go back to my desk, and that's it.
Now, though, as of this week in my office, the IT department has gotten their own coffee machine, so we no longer have to leave the office to go get coffee. So I can be a lazy ass if I want and just roll my chair over to the coffee machine if I want, but I will I will use my strength to get out of my chair and walk the 3 meters over to the coffee machine just to make my blue ring fill up.
Yeah, and maybe if I go on a small tangent regarding those notification, like during the weekend or during when I'm not at work, I wouldn't like this feature that we'll be speaking about. But if I'm at work and I see the notification at the 50th minute of the hour, I would like to get another reminder maybe 5 minutes after or a couple of minutes after. Because sometimes what happens is I buzz, the watch just buzzes, and I'm like, oh, wait, but I need to finish this line first. And then I kind of forgot that I need to go grab water. And it's like 15 minutes in the next hour already. And I forgot. Like, and then I just realized that I forgot. I'm just like, oh, okay, that's fine.
Yep. Luckily, I sort of have to track my tasks. Track the amount of time I spend per task. So I look at the clock a lot, because I want to be able to note down how much time I've spent on each task. So that reminds me, basically, that I haven't been standing much if I don't pay attention to the notifications or forget about the notifications. Last one is sort of a selfish thing, because I use public transit and I rely on buses to leave the office that are only in operation during school days. So basically, if it's a school day, buses will go at a 15-minute schedule downtown where I work. And this means I can get home sooner. The problem is, since I don't go to school anymore, I don't know if schools are open or not anymore. And I've really, 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 really been wanting this week to be able to ask Siri if schools are closed today and get a response. I realize that that is quite a bit of a challenge to actually implement correctly for everyone. But it seems barbaric that it's 2016. We all have like phones in our pockets and we still have to sit in front of a TV and wait for the name of our school board to scroll on a TV screen to know if schools are closed. And that doesn't actually come in handy when it's 4:30 p.m. and I still don't know if schools are closed or not. And I don't know if my bus is just not showing up or if it's really, really late.
I think Radio Canada has a web service for that.
Awesome. They should have it on the Apple Watch because I would use that.
I think it's a part of their website, though. And yeah, it might be for big cities, though.
But like, I would love it if something like Google Now or Siri could connect to that and just tell me like, yeah, schools are closed right now, so screw you. You're not taking the bus until another half hour.
Hey, and I'm sure like tons of parents around the world that lives in Nordic climate would like to just ask Siri when they wake up. And say something like, hey, Siri, blah, 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 blah. Is the school closes today? Because I know that we're supposed to have a big snowstorm.
Yep.
Like, it feels something we should be able to have. But, hey, maybe in 2017.
Maybe. So, I said we were going to end on a good note. So, that's pretty much it. Let's end there. Because I have other notes under this, but they're all complaints. So, I'd rather just skip them.
I do have, maybe, if we're speaking about the Apple Watch, I think I mentioned that in the past episode that these days I started to use my Apple Watch a lot more.
Yep.
And the main reason was because of Sleep Plus Plus. Sleep Plus Plus has been amazing until I updated to the next version, the version 2.0 that got released recently, and then the watch went kaput for a day or two. Like, I don't know why, either the application was crashing, so, and when it does that, it means the application was not updated properly. So you just need to uninstall it and reinstall it manually, and it should work. After doing so, I was running into HealthKit authorization issues, saying that I need to authorize Sleep Plus to access to my HealthKit data, which was already authorized. And it seems to me that what fixed it was going back in HealthKit and just turning them back off and on again, and it worked. So hopefully, like, if you have any permission issues with the Apple Watch, it is yet again a synchronization issue and you just need to turn it back off and on again, and then it will re-trigger the event. But remove it, like, ignoring all of these, it feels to me that some developers these days have found the way of doing nice performant watch app. And yes, they will run into limitation of the SDK and small like edge cases of them, but in most cases it is feasible to have a good experience and adapt some application and some workflows to the watch and not feel like it's dumbed down version of the iPhone app.
Yep. I found OmniFocus to be probably the most reliable of the watch OS apps that I've been using recently, and on top of that, I think a large part of the reliability issues we're seeing, not only because of the protocols and everything that Apple's developed, but I think third-party developers for a long, long time have been lazy about handling errors. And I think that on the Apple Watch more than ever, you need to do error handling properly because it will fail often. And I think it's hard to tell sometimes, but I have a feeling that a lot of the applications that are not very useful or not reliable are just doing crappy error handling on top of the protocol failing on them. And then you just can't really do anything useful with those applications at all. And that's all I've got.
Good. Yeah, it's a good idea to stop now.
Yep.
Good. So if you want to take a look at our show notes for this week's episode, this week's episode has been our 34th episode, and you can go on our website at limitlesspossibility.net/34. If you want to take a look at our other episodes and our other show notes, you can go to limitlesspossibility.net. You can also find our podcast on Twitter, and that's at limipo_podcast. That's LIMIPO_podcast. You can also find myself on Twitter at Lucanouche. That's LUCCONOUCHE. And you can find Yannick at
Sakurina, SAKURINA.
See you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.